This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal land in Sydney. This Tuesday, the federal government pushes ahead with its campaign for the Indigenous voice to Parliament. And borrowers brace for yet another interest rate rise as the Reserve Bank continues its fight against inflation.
It's pretty scary because it's only 2 years after we've bought out, so we haven't paid that much off the house yet.
It's so stressful because our grocery bill is huge.
It's been very frustrating, and then everything else is going up on top of that. So like with fuel, like, you know, sometimes we've got enough to get stuff, sometimes it doesn't, so it does make a huge impact on us. But what can you do, I guess?
First today, a massive humanitarian crisis is unfolding in Turkey and Syria after a series of powerful earthquakes flattened entire neighbourhoods, killing more than 3,500 people. The 7.8 magnitude quake hit southeast Turkey and northern Syria yesterday, followed by a second 7.6 quake just 9 hours later. Rescue efforts are being hampered by severe winter weather. And in Syria, the quake follows years of fighting, displacement and destruction in the war-torn country. Thousands of people are now left without shelter, searching for loved ones among the rubble. Catherine Gregory reports.
The quakes just kept coming. This live television broadcast relaying news of the first 7.8 earthquake in the central eastern Turkish city of Malatya, interrupted by another shockwave. More buildings collapse, covering people and the street in dust. The reporter rescues a young girl from the rubble. As night fell in Hatay, the southern part of eastern Turkey, the screams of people still trapped under the rubble filled the air. This man is trying to rescue people trapped under collapsed concrete.
As you can see, there's a dead body here and no one is removing him. And we just heard a woman's voice from underneath the rubble.
Another local man called Deniz, desperate for some kind of assistance to help the people trapped.
We heard them. They were calling out, asking for help. They asked to be rescued, but we cannot rescue them. How can we rescue them? Nobody's come since this morning. Nobody. We have nobody.
The initial 7.8 earthquake struck the Turkish-Syrian border in the early hours of Monday morning local time, killing thousands of people, injuring thousands more and toppling countless buildings. Large swathes of eastern Turkey and northern Syria have been affected. And now, as aftershocks continue, people struggle to find shelter among the rubble and the blistering cold. The snow also blocking roads and hampering rescue efforts. These families at the quake's epicentre in Kahraman Manas huddle around a bonfire, desperate for warmth, as temperatures drop below freezing.
Our houses have been damaged. We cannot go inside now. We haven't eaten anything since morning. Our children are very hungry.
Turkish authorities have declared 7 days of national mourning. In Syria, survivors grapple with a worsening humanitarian crisis. It comes after more than a decade of civil war. In the capital, Aleppo, people search the rubble for survivors while the dead are wrapped up, lining the streets in body bags.
A whole family of my cousin, his wife, his daughter and his son, all of them died. They were taken out from under the rubble after about 8 hours.
Obadar Alwan is a member of the Syrian Civil Defence Force, also known as the White Helmets. He's located in Istanbul. He says it's incredibly difficult on the ground in Syria at the moment. It's also unclear how many people have died.
Volunteers, Syria Civil Defence volunteers, are completely run thin in terms of resources, in terms of manpower. The situation is just very catastrophic right now on the ground. And the main problem is that northwest Syria is in the midst of a huge winter storm. The biggest issue is that there's no shelter, there's nowhere to go for safety.
He says many people in Syria were already displaced from the war.
The reason why this earthquake is so devastating is because of the past, more than decade of war and constant bombing and weak and flimsy infrastructure and inadequate humanitarian aid and response.
Authorities fear the death toll in both countries will continue to rise. International rescue teams are arriving now in Turkey. Balazs Weaveri is the European Commission's spokesman for humanitarian aid and crisis management, and he's in Brussels. He says Turkey has activated the EU civil mechanism, which helped deal with natural disasters, and 20 search and rescue teams have been mobilised.
When there's an earthquake, there are also many other challenges, be it in terms of water and sanitation, or blankets, shelter, or hygienic items. The mechanism that we have can also be used for demanding, asking for such items. So Turkey is very much, of course, welcome to request this type of assistance as well.
The support for Syria is a bit different.
Given the fact that Syria has not activated the EU civil protection mechanism, which I have just described, this means that we cannot act through this structure. So what we do there is to go through our humanitarian operations.
The US is also offering additional funding to help rescue efforts and has deployed a team of disaster response specialists.
That's Catherine Gregory. Australia's Turkish community is rallying in response to the earthquake disaster. I spoke a short time ago to Turkey's ambassador to Australia, Ufuk Gezev.
It is too early to say. The estimations are still continuing. But what we can say is that the area being affected by the earthquake is quite large. It has affected actually 10 provinces where around 13.5 million people are living. So that means the effort required to bring help is huge. I mean, you need to be present at 10 different provinces at the same time, trying to help a lot of people. So that is a gigantic task. And the government immediately has organized a coordination center, and the presidency is overseeing the efforts. You know, they're trying to bring in help as quickly as possible. But mind you, the severity of the crisis, the earthquake, is quite serious, that the infrastructure has also been affected. So bringing in help also has its challenges. We're trying to overcome all that.
What sort of assistance is Turkey looking for from the international community?
We have called on international assistance and asked for mainly two items. The first one is the medical equipment. And the second one is rescue teams. In order to help with the rescue efforts, we need medium and heavy rescue teams in order to lift the heavy rubble and bring in, expertise. There are special dogs looking for people under the rubble, etc. And thankfully, a lot of countries have responded positively to our call. As we speak, around 45 different countries have already dispatched rescue teams to help with the efforts. And the EU and NATO also are planning to send more. So it's a coordinated effort, and it requires the joining hands with international partners and our national resources.
What has the reaction been from the Turkish community here in Australia?
An outpouring of sympathy and support from the minute that it was known. A lot of Turkish community are trying to organize among themselves to raise funds, donation campaigns, etc. So an immediate reaction. We are trying to set up an embassy account for donations as well, so that we can streamline various donation campaigns and we can get the much needed funds directly to the earthquake victims.
What sort of concerns are there at the moment from the Turkish community in Australia about loved ones who may have been caught in this situation?
In the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, the GSM operators, they were down for a couple of hours. So we were reached by many people asking about their loved ones, etc. But now the systems are up. Thankfully, the communication systems are working, and we've been reached by many of the Turkish community members here. Our consulates in Sydney and Melbourne are constantly responding calls. Our embassies also doing the same. We're trying to help them to the best of our abilities.
If people are worried about relatives who may be in Turkey, what do they do?
We have a hotline in Turkey as well. We have a disaster management authority, which is coordinating the efforts. They can try to reach the hotline. They can try to reach our consulates and the embassy. They can send us an email. We try to get back to them as soon as possible.
This emergency response on the ground is still in its very early stages. What did Turkey Air learn from the big quake more than 20 years ago about how long the process of recovery can be?
It could be a long and arduous process, unfortunately, because it requires diligent work of picking up the rubble, lifting the hard concrete slabs without harming the people who may be trapped underneath. So going in quite fast and with the necessary expertise, in a nutshell, is what we need at the moment.
That's Turkey's ambassador to Australia, Ufuk Gazev, speaking there. Many Australian homeowners are bracing for more financial pain ahead of the Reserve Bank's interest rate announcement this afternoon. Our reporter Stephanie Smale has spoken to three young parents, one couple with a fixed rate due to end soon, a mother whose mortgage is already on a variable rate, and Melbourne husband and wife Marty and Emma, who have an 11-week-old. Their fixed interest rate is due to end in August.
It's pretty scary because it's only 2 years after we've bought out, so we haven't paid that much off the house yet.
Do you have a buffer? What are you thinking of in terms of repayments?
We had a buffer and we still have a buffer. I'm now on maternity leave, which means a pay cut, which was not factored into when we bought the house, but we knew we were going to have kids. We just have to be more conservative with our spending. It's so stressful. Marty, my husband, had 2 weeks off via Centrelink. He took a bit of extra leave. I think under annual leave you took, it's not enough, but like you financially have to go back to work because our grocery bill is huge. We bought our house in May 2021 and interest rates were low, which helped us a lot. So we kind of knew it was going to ricochet. It's ricocheted probably quicker than we thought.
We have a mortgage broker and we've been in contact with them since, and we've always had a plan of like after 2 years reassessing what we can do and make sure we're paying as little as we can. So whether that means switch to a different bank, whatever we can.
It's been very frustrating, and then everything else is going up on top of that. So like with fuel, like, you know, sometimes we've got enough to get stuff, sometimes it doesn't, so it does make a huge impact on us. We'll have to just cope, I guess, like everyone else, but it's not exactly the best, but what can you do, I guess?
That's some borrowers there speaking to our reporter Stephanie Smale. Well, after 8 consecutive interest rate rises last year, how far is the RBA expected to go with its latest announcement today? I spoke earlier with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Well, Sally, it sounds like there's going to be more rates pain, whatever the outcome this afternoon. Money markets see an 82% chance of the RBA cash rate rising by a quarter of a percentage point to 3.35%. Now, that's the standard increment the RBA likes to use. But given that annual inflation is running hot at 7.8%, there's an outside risk the RBA board will opt to take out the sledgehammer and go in harder with a supersized hike of as much as half a percentage point. And we saw that last year in June, July, August and September. So the RBA board has form. Now, the risk for the RBA is that while they reckon inflation has peaked, it's not showing much sign of falling rapidly. And unless they go in hard now, they'll just have to keep raising rates for longer. The longer they do that, the risk of a recession gets greater. But it's not just the size of the rate hike. It's going to be the language in the RBA statement that comes after the decision and whether there's a change in that hawkish tone.
Peter, these rate rises are designed to try and cool demand in the economy so that inflation falls. Are we seeing any evidence that it's working?
Well, Sally, we know that retail sales in December fell by a pretty sharp 3.9%, according to the ABS, but that might not be a sign that consumers are necessarily pulling back. One view is that these days, December spending in the lead up to Christmas isn't really reflective of reality because consumers are doing their Christmas shopping in November with the big sales on Black Friday and Cyber Monday. So the RBA will be looking for more tangible evidence of a pullback. Also, where good news is bad news in a way, around $250 billion in extra repayments piled up during the pandemic means that rate rises aren't hurting as much as you might expect, and people are dipping into that buffer to keep their lifestyles going rather than pulling back, which is what the RBA wants.
Peter, what about later in the year when some borrowers on fixed rate mortgages face the mortgage cliff as those rates end? What are we expecting then?
Well, the Reserve Bank estimates around 800,000 borrowers will be coming off those fixed rates later this year on loans valued around $350 billion. Banks are now rushing to offer products for a higher rates world. And this morning, the NAB online bank UBank said it would extend its maximum loan term for borrowers who are refinancing from 30 years up to 35 years. Now, most of those are currently on very low rates of just under 2%. And Sally Tindall from the research house Rate City says when those expire, there's a painful reality check in store for borrowers who were betting variable rates would stay near zero until 2024.
Oh, an amazing shock, because every time the RBA hikes the rate, they are laughing all the way to the bank, quite literally, because they haven't paid an extra cent on their mortgage until the honeymoon ends, and it will go up with an almighty bang. They're looking at revert rates of around 7.18%. That's almost a quadrupling of their rate overnight. Their monthly repayments will go up by 65%, 65% on their biggest monthly bill typically. That's going to be a really difficult task for some people. We may find that some people just can't make it.
That's Sally Tindall there from Rate City, and a short time ago, our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. You're listening to The World Today. Well, now that the Greens have declared their position on the Indigenous voice to Parliament, all eyes are turning to the Liberal Party. Opposition leader Peter Dutton has hinted that a decision is imminent, but he continues to push the government for more detail. So where do Australian voters stand on the issue? Rachel Mealy reports.
The Greens will back the Yes campaign supporting an Indigenous voice to Parliament. Leader Adam Bandt says the party speaks as one.
We're now excited to get behind the campaign for voice, and we will be campaigning strongly for a successful referendum for a yes vote.
Lydia Thorpe stepped down from the party after months of division on the issue. She didn't want to support a voice to Parliament and was pushing instead for a treaty. Now that she's gone, the Greens say there are no more mixed messages, though the party's position is still complicated.
Because our position is still that we think that we won't have First Nations justice in this country until we have truth and treaty as well as a voice. And our policy is and remains that we would like to see a treaty first.
Then on the question of what the voice would look like, senior Labor figures are avoiding questions about whether the voice to Parliament would have a permanent seat in National Cabinet. The Minister for Indigenous Australians, Linda Burney, dodged the question a number of times.
Critical role for the voice is to make sure that it provides advice to the parliament across the parliament.
Then, on the other side of politics, Peter Dutton says an announcement from the Liberal Party is imminent, but he's asking the government for a bill to be put to the parliament to explain how it's all going to work.
Day after day, we hear these different thought bubbles from the government. I think what would give people more assurance is if there is a bill that can explain how it's going to work. People recognise that changing the constitution is a very significant decision to make. And if you're changing the law, as the government can do now, they can introduce the voice by way of legislation tomorrow, and they could demonstrate how it works.
Cos Samaras is a former campaigner for the Labor Party, who is now a director of the Redbridge Group, which carries out social research. He says the public discourse on the voice is cluttered.
I think when it comes to public sentiment, the general view is, well, there isn't one. I think a large section of the Australian population is still very unsure as to what the voice actually means. So there's still a lot of ambiguity out there, people not sure what is the actual detail and so on.
Cos Samaras says the opposition leader's call for more information isn't having the negative impact many think it will.
I think that it certainly is at least allowing the Liberal Party to now have a much more broader and mature debate. And I think, by the sounds of it, they're probably going to reach to a yes position.
But as the year rolls on towards a likely October referendum, will voters become bored and disengaged?
I think the danger for the Yes campaign is one of apathy more than anything else. The Voice is not a top-of-mind issue for a lot of voters out there. When we talk to people out there, they are focusing on issues that are pressing on them day-to-day, financial stress, mortgage rate rises, rental stress, lack of supply of rental properties and so on in our large cities. That's effectively what is animating the electorate at the moment. And Voice is the secondary issue for some elements of our community and others are completely oblivious to it.
That's Cos Samaras there, director of the Redbridge Group, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. Finally today, Australia's thriving African community has grown fast over the past 20 years and it's made a big contribution to the cultural landscape. But a growing number of people from African backgrounds are also making their mark as small business owners. Everything from local grocery stores to selling hair products and African fabrics. The entrepreneurial drive of African Australians is popping up in suburbs across the country. Now, a new study is examining their impact on the national economy. Gladys Saruga reports.
6 years ago, there's no way you'd find this in Sydney's inner suburbs, a Nigerian restaurant packed with customers.
The first big thing that we noticed was like, when it comes to the food, like Australians didn't eat a lot of goat. They actually didn't like it at all. They would go, what, goat? They thought it was smelly. And we were like, no, this is the most amazing like meat you could have. It's healthy as well. So if you would ask me about our biggest contribution, I would say it's like making sure goat meat became a staple in Australia.
Little Lagos opened in 2017. Its owner, Ade Adeniyi, says the initial trade was tough.
So when we started, obviously, it was a very small scale, you know, just markets once every few months. We saw a big jump in the numbers around 2019 when the pop-ups in the markets became more consistent. It's a bit funny for us because even though we've seen this massive jump in our numbers, we've only traded through COVID. So that's something that's very important because we actually opened the permanent shop about 2 months before the country went into, I think it was stage four lockdown at that point. So I would say the first year or first 2 years of trading, maybe we're sitting around, you could say $20,000 to $30,000. By the third or fourth year, we were looking at about $500,000.
This success of this restaurant is part of a growing trend. African Australian entrepreneurs are popping up all over the country.
That one's specifically for your edges, so that's what we'll tame it. Keep it.
Ayan Abdirashid Ali's parents opened the Afro Oz Superstore in Adelaide's western suburbs in 2007, selling hair products, food, and a plethora of other products.
I would say that it's incredibly important in terms of representation and making it known that African communities do exist here in Australia and they do contribute, you know, positively.
And she says it's not just customers of African descent who come into the shop.
And a lot of the times during summer, we get a lot of Australians who come in as well, wanting to braid their hair. And yeah, we've got an amazing variety, I'd say.
A new study by a group of seven Australian universities is trying to gauge the contribution of Africans to the national economy. It's led by sociologist Farida Fosda from Curtin University.
What we've seen anecdotally is that many communities, and particularly those of African backgrounds, are taking active steps both to be engaged politically in civil society, but also particularly in the areas of business and work-related activity. And so we want to be able to tell those positive stories.
She says there's very little data available, something she's hoping to change.
Because often the research that has been undertaken has looked at people's access to the welfare system and unemployment issues, as I mentioned, rather than focusing on the contributions that some of these communities are making.
Professor Fosda says the study also wants to examine how Africans in Australia are contributing economically to communities back in Africa. The study will run for 2 years, and the team hopes it will work as a guide for future governments making policies affecting African Australians.
That's Gladys Saruga with that report. That's it from the world today for this Tuesday. We'll be following the events in Turkey and Syria, where a massive humanitarian crisis is unfolding after a series of powerful earthquakes. that flattened entire neighbourhoods. The 7.8 magnitude quake was followed by a second 7.6 quake just 9 hours later. ABC News on radio, television and online will continue to follow the story. I'm Sally Sara. Stay tuned to the ABC. We'll be back again at the same time tomorrow. Take care.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. China says it was simply a weather balloon gone astray, but the Pentagon says Beijing was spying. Today, an aerospace engineer and national security expert on what China's up to. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.